Hello, dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Lapai Disiso Talks. Today we're joined by Omar Cohen, Chief Security Officer at Descope, a rapidly growing startup that helps every developer build secure, frictionless authentication and user journeys for any application.
Okay, so let's talk about something real quick that's been a total game changer for us really here at Lapide, and that's been Magic Mind.
Yes, it's been what, 7 days now? And seriously, I can't believe how much sharper and more focused I feel.
Yeah, I mean, same here. It's like a calm focus. There's none of that jitteriness, no 3 p.m. caffeine crash, none of that stuff really. And what is Magic Mind, you ask? Well, Magic Mind is a little daily shot. And it's packed with nootropics, adaptogens, vitamins. But it's not a coffee replacement though. But it does make my coffee work better.
Yeah, exactly. Plus, it's science developed by doctors with over 200 existing studies and is obviously 100% safe. I've noticed I'm just getting so much more done without feeling stressed at all.
Yeah, I mean, if you've been struggling with the similar stuff really to us, and distractions are getting in your way, then try Magic Mind. Honestly, it's been totally worth it for us. And just head over to magicmind.com. Use the code CISOTALKS20 in the description below. That will give you a discount. And yeah, I mean, I'm going to keep drinking this because it's improving my workflow and my days. So happy
Yeah,
days.
me too. Seriously, it's like focus in a bottle. All right, well, back to the show.
Omar is a seasoned incident response investigator and leader with 15 years of experience in cybersecurity, software development, and cloud architecture. He excels in guiding teams through high-pressure situations and has successfully implemented cutting-edge technologies for security applications. His experience in cloud-native solutions has benefited Fortune 500 companies such as Palo Alto Networks, Yahoo, General Motors, and eBay, making him a top consultant in the field and an exciting guest for CISO Talks. Welcome, Omar, to the show. It's a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you. That was a mouthful. I'm kind of embarrassed, but glad to be here.
Sorry, I didn't mean to embarrass you. Just sort of reeling off the LinkedIn profile, so probably nothing, no surprises there for you, but certainly good for our listeners to understand sort of the caliber of guests we have on the show. Obviously, given that your wealth of experience in those areas, I think it's a kind of a no-brainer that the focus of today's talk will center around incident response, and in particular, would like to talk about restoring trust after a cyber attack incident.
Absolutely, that's key.
Yeah, so just to kind of kick off, so what would you say are some key strategies that CISOs can use to quickly restore trust with their customers and stakeholders after a cyber attack? Because the reputational damage is always one of those big, scary parts.
Absolutely. It actually makes me want to take a step back into dealing with the incident. When I used to do incident response, the most important factor in our ability to manage an incident successfully doesn't really matter the outcome. It matters the way we've handled it. The most important factor was communication, being able to have clear channels and designated people for different roles, so you know what to expect from who, at what stage, et cetera. That made a huge difference in the way we managed the incident. And when I look at a post-incident communication, restoring trust, talking to your customers after the incident, it's an incident of its own, right? Even once inside the company, it's resolved, it's done. You know what happened, you resolved everything. Now you need to talk to your customers. Actually, depending on the type of incident, that may happen sooner than when you actually finished investigating internally. But it's a separate ordeal that you need to manage with your customers, with the industry, the entire ecosystem. So communication is critical there. It's about getting in touch with your customers as soon as possible, as soon as you would like to be notified of something similar if you were the victim or the target of an incident. So timing and communication, that's one of the top factors in starting on the right foot, you know, to be able to restore your customer trust. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. I suppose, you know, as well, the quicker the response, I suppose the more control you have over the narrative of the incident, of the breach, rather than it sort of getting leaked through other news sources that there was some breach or, you know, customer or client data was lost. So, yeah, communicating that yourself should be a priority. And there's, I suppose, there's also a duty of care from the company to its customers, to its stakeholders, to communicate in a truthful manner.
Yeah. And once you start that, and like you said, it's getting ahead of maybe rumors or misinformation that may go out there. I have a ton of respect for those companies, and we can name a few, but that go out with a public announcement, even if it's not a security breach, but it's a critical infrastructure incident that is impacting their customers. It's important to get ahead and notify. And even if you don't know exactly what happened, just making sure that your audience, your customers know that you're working on it, you're on top of it. Even that by itself provides some sort of control, like you said, some sort of trust by the affected parties. Saying like, okay, something's going on. I know I'm affected. We may have some disruption of service. We may, you know, if some information was leaked, we may need to rotate some keys. We may need to, you know, to talk to our customers, you know, depending on what type of vendor that is. It helps me prepare as a customer. Because there's a supply chain here and it can go on for several steps, you know, depending on what exactly happened. So having that conversation, even, you know, getting on a phone or Zoom or whatever with the more sensitive, precious customers, or, you know, even if it's 1 or 1,000 customers, you may need to do it with all of them, depending on the type of breach.
Yeah. As a customer, there's nothing worse than being left in the dark, and left guessing, you know, what's the extent of the fallout? How is this going to affect, as you said, the supply chain and the knock-on effects, like, you know, like with the big global incidents that happened in the past, you know, you're not Petyr's of the world and, you know, like a Maersk type incident, you know, and this, you know, supply chain is so long that you just have a constant knock-on effect. So yeah, that communication piece is super important. I completely agree with you there. So hypothetically, let's imagine there were some kind of breach that's occurred. What would be sort of your go-to best practices and technologies that you found effective in the past, or that you would sort of kind of gravitate towards in responding to and containing a breach? And how would you communicate that to the public?
So a lot of it depends on the actions and tools that you use leading up to that breach. So I actually had a conversation with someone today about, you know, the balance of controls and restrictions versus productivity. I'm a strong believer in that balance. As long as I have the ability to at least have visibility into what's going on, right? One hot topic that keeps coming up in different companies I work with is sharing of just a, you know, a Drive documents, Google Drive or SharePoint or whatever it is. It's a huge blocker to productivity when I can't you know, share information with people I'm doing business with. But as a security practitioner, it's a huge risk for me to just allow anybody to share anything with everybody. And I found the balance is allow people to do whatever they need to do as part of the job, as long as I'm able to protect the interests that I need to protect without essentially just blocking whatever they're trying to do. So if I get notified, if the user gets notified whenever they share something external, they may keep track of it. They may remove that share eventually. And if we had an incident where, a document was shared publicly with some sensitive information, et cetera, we can then go and track how did that happen, right? Who accessed that document? Who was exposed to it? We have an audit log, et cetera. So when it comes to auditing and investigation and gathering and investigating what ended up in this incident, again, goes to the communication, being able to provide as much information as I can about the breach, about the incident, is crucial. And without the work leading up to it, I won't be able to do it. So it's about, audit and log management, permissions, things like that, that even if you do need to open permissions for something, you need to still have some sort of audit. And there's no specific tool or technology when that comes into to action. It's the methodology that you need to use, whatever product works for you, works for your business, as long as it gives you those capabilities.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, Lapide is one of those products that's very close to home for, obviously keeping those granular level audit trails and being able to go back and do that forensic level investigation. And you're right, it is about just being able to understand what happened in the run up to an incident, connecting the dots. So actually you can learn from those events. But also like just that visibility and awareness piece that you can, you rightly said, don't restrict the access, don't restrict the ability to, for the workers to collaborate, to work freely. But when some data does become overexposed or, the threat surface has increased, you can actually go, well, hold on a sec. Did you know that you were actually putting some sensitive data there out there and not removing it subsequently? So yeah, definitely. It's something we talk about a lot here at Lapide. And so how would you say CISOs can balance the need for transparency and disclosure with the need to protect sensitive information about a breach and the company's security posture? So, we don't try to sort of ambulance chase in our company, but it does happen. And of course, when there is a breach, you kind of want to be careful what you tell people without giving away too much information, right?
Yeah, I mean, a good example I can look at is that just a few days ago, HubSpot had an incident, and they came out very plainly and said, we've had an incident where some accounts were accessed, this information and that information was exposed, this was not exposed. So being able to categorize the extent and scope of the breach. And actually, going back to the previous point, if I don't balance those controls and I become too restrictive, my users will find a way around it. Right. If I don't allow sharing with proper monitoring, if I don't allow sharing at all, people will just, send it through their personal Gmail, and then I lose all visibility about what's going on. So if I have that capability to, like when HubSpot came out and said, this is what was impacted, this is what was not impacted. If you were impacted, we would reach out to you specifically and have a conversation with you about the details. So in this case, I didn't hear anything from them, so I assume I wasn't breached, but I had the confidence that they're on top of things, they're handling things the way they should, you know, if I was exposed to more details, I might have thought otherwise, but luckily or not, I wasn't. But just as a bystander, seeing the way they manage it and knowing that they give those kind of shallow enough detail to know the scale and depth of that impact, together with knowing that if I need more information that is relevant to me, I'm going to get whatever information I need to be able to handle this, I think strikes the balance between visibility to the public to produce a level of transparency when it comes to security breaches, as well as maintaining my control over the incident, but not by not just expanding everything and sharing everything that happened that may be interpreted wrongly, because that's also the balance that if you share too much information, if you say too many things, people will interpret it however they want. So you need to be able to control the narrative, like you said.
Definitely a complex thing when people are losing their heads around you as well, to not do some kind of knee-jerk reaction to an incident. Would you say it's the same in all sides of organizations? Obviously, you've worked with startups all the way through to Fortune 500s. Does it differ based on the scale of the organization?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Once the company is large enough to have, a whole internal kind of a PR or communication department, it becomes kind of rings of trust around the incident of what you're able to share and how you communicate what to whom. Because there's a way to manage communication internally within the company. There's a way to manage communication with the board, steering committee, the CEO, and then as well as the public and the actual customers. And you need to be able to share the right information with the right people at the right time. So again, that becomes its whole incident. So if I used to work for a large company like that, we would have a dedicated person in charge of communication. And that person would gather the information from the incident manager, from the analysts, and work with the legal and PR first to be able to even know what, as a company, we're legally obligated to disclose, depending on the different regions that you do business at, as well as allow that transparency. So this is an entire operation for a large company. When it's a smaller company, everybody wears many different hats. Depending on usually when it's a smaller startup, there's a lot of trust internally between people, so you're able to work more freely. There's no all that kind of corporate language and maybe some barriers that happens in larger companies where people are politics and all that kind of stuff. So it's a different animal. But still, the external communication, I would expect, a 50-people company to communicate externally the same as a 50,000-people company, with the utmost respect, transparency, and understanding of the end user that's impacted.
It kind of calls into question, though, how thin your team will be stretched to be able to respond in such a mature way, because when you're a small organization, the IT team and the surrounding positions are a little bit less mature, perhaps. Not to mention the skill shortage in the industry. I know it's something that we've kind of touched upon in the past. And I think go on.
So on the external communication part, hire a PR company, hire a comms expert, at a certain point when you deal with sensitive customer information, you really should have someone on retainer to be able to call, there's cyber insurance, that helps have those kind of resources available to you. Use them, you know, prepare in advance. It should be part of your, you know, your BCP in a way that would allow you to not just, you know, restore your resources and servers and whatever, but, you know, retain your business. You know, business continuity is not just disaster recovery, right? It's, I want to be able to continue my business, even if my entire infrastructure is up, if people don't use my product anymore because they don't trust the word that comes out of my mouth, I'm going to be out of business really quick. So no matter the size of the company, it's part of the investment. Just like you invest in the right people and the right resources and the right technology, invest in the way you communicate with your customers. People spend, you know, tens and thousands of dollars on their website. It's just a public static website. It has no functionality at all of my application, but it communicates your level of as a company.
Yeah, it's kind of a form of digital corporate social responsibility.
Right.
That same umbrella, isn't it? How much of that would you say is genuine, and or is it just kind of led by compliance and the need to meet compliance?
That's a great question. I'm naive enough to want to believe that it's mostly genuine, but then there's a lot of companies out there and people that just don't care. So
they can get away with it.
It's good to have. Yeah. Yeah, you know, if nobody knows,
yeah,
it's all good. You know, and then you look back at the last, you know, year and a half with all the changes in Europe and the U.S. between, you know, that executive order to demand breach notifications, as well as in Europe. I think it's good to some extent that as a consumer, I know that my service providers are obligated to do certain things because it ends up feeding the whole ecosystem. If as an internet user, I don't trust services on the internet, I'm not going to use them. And then it all kind of cycles down. So I'm for compliance in a certain level. But you know, it's always a balance. How strictly, how detailed the framework should be to be able to allow me to do my business, and not just focusing on crossing T's and dotting I's all day to not get a lawsuit.
And you've worked in a lot of startups as well. Have you seen that sort of compliance piece come in from an early stage, you know, at a foundational level, just kind of getting it done early rather than putting it off? And then what does that look like?
It really depends on the type of company, the type of people, because and the business, of course. If you have the ability, so here at Descope, I started on day one of the company. I knew I was going to work with these people again. And I had the privilege to be a security person at the company at the first day of the company before there was even a product. That's one of the reasons that we were SOC 2 compliant in 3-4 months after we started working. After we had the product, which was about nine months or so. But being able to do all those compliance integrated into the way the company is built early on, even as a CISO, helps me build the security program that I want to build for my company. Relying on these frameworks early on first puts me in line with industry standards and helps me even as a smaller team really capture all the components that I should do, right? If you're doing, you know, SOC 2, you need to have proper audit logs, and you need to have proper change management. It was like, okay, those are maybe type of things that if I'm rushing to build a product and rushing to get my product to market, I may neglect those things and worry about them later on. But if I use that framework to help lead my work as I go along, it's a lot easier doing that early on than later on, because driving those changes back into the product, back into the even just company culture, right, is going to be challenging. I've had the opportunity to, like, here to do SOC 2 and compliance from day one, and I've also had the opportunity to do it maybe 18 months into the company, and it's a whole different ballpark. It's completely different in the way even just the people in the company adopt that change. So when it's part of the culture from day one, it's great. When the last thing I'll say is, when you do that early on, you have the opportunity to really automate and tool all those things for you and build on top of it. So it's much easier to maintain as you grow, as you scale. I'm still a one-person security team, managing, I want to say, 5 or 6 different compliance frameworks, privacy frameworks, being able to monitor all the different controls, hundreds of different controls, just because I was able to do it early on and automate it, makes my life a lot easier.
I'm sure it's a lot easier to understand how it all fits together when you're the one who built it from the ground up and started off on the right foot, rather than inheriting some kind of mess from some predecessor. I can definitely see how that would be a privileged position to be in for yourself. And I know you guys at Descope are sort of cloud first strategy as well, so it's kind of heavily geared towards that. So you don't have any kind of legacy on-prem systems and things like that to deal with, which is also probably quite a breath of fresh air.
Yeah. And that's also something when it comes to just protecting identities and your users at the company, et cetera, using those cloud technologies, using some sort of a CASB or something else to help you even just identify all the different services that you use. Even at retrospect, if that would start today, 2.5 years into the company, because the company is cloud first, that's a huge advantage. So it's easy for me to find what all of my employees are using, try and enforce SAML and everything I can to try and control the usage. And then I can do that both from a security standpoint and also from a privacy standpoint to say, where is my information going? What are they doing with it? How it's being shared? Are we honoring our commitment to our customers to protecting their data with the different tools and software that we use? It's not fair, but it's a much harder job for someone to manage security for, a 25-year-old company rather than a 2.5-year-old company.
Yeah, definitely. And I suppose that kind of leads back to your ability to be a lot more lean as a security team, or a one man band, as you put it yourself. Probably a lot less expensive, I imagine.
And that's also something to balance between the spending on tools versus spending on people. If you spend on the right tools, you don't need as many people, right? People sometimes feel bad spending tens of thousands of dollars a year, $100,000 a year on a tool. It's like, I can have someone do that for me, but then they'll be doing just that. They'll get burned out after a year or less. So using the right tools and automation would actually save you money at headcount, which is sometimes the first thing to go rather than the last, oddly, when you're doing budget cuts. Because, I have this 3-year commitment to this vendor. I can't really break out of it, but you can definitely fire people if you need to cut your budget. But then you lose on both ends, because you lose the people You lose the morale of the company, and you lose the working hands that used to do that work that kept you safe. So another reason that I depend mostly on automation. But again, visibility, communication, I need to be able to still stay on top of what's going on and not have like a black box and just to be blind on what's going on.
Is there any, you know, when we do have these kind of shocks in the economy and people do get laid off, I don't know, is there any way that you can think of that some IT professionals, especially security professionals, can kind of future-proof themselves against that? kind of an odd question, but...
With the way
technology is heading and so on, and AI, you know, there'll definitely be some redundant roles and skills, but
it's tricky. Like, you don't want to hold on to a job or a responsibility, or you know, fight technology and automation just so you don't get fired, because eventually that would happen some way or another. Others are sometimes those people that are some sort of a central center of knowledge where it's going to be hard to manage without them. But if that person is good enough at, has enough skills that was able to get them to where they are, those skills will be appreciated anywhere. And that's oddly the reason they would likely not be laid off, because they're valued. So it's not about, you know, having access to the system that only you know how to manage and maintain and the company will collapse without you. I think it's the exact opposite. You know, be that one person that actually nothing depends on, which means everybody can depend on you to get things done. And you have everything figured out, so they would want to keep you to keep things as smooth.
Be dependable, be reliable, have lots of skills, be they transferable or specific to or technology.
Yeah, because if you focus and narrow down on one specialty, no matter I guess the complexity, everybody can be replaced. Which is, it's also a good thing. But you're likely not to be replaced if you're trustworthy, if you're reliable. Not because you can code that language that nobody else can and you know that tool that nobody else does. Because people can learn tools and languages. But it's the right people that end up staying behind and helping, you know, keep the companies together.
You say there's enough of that kind of talent where you are in Tel Aviv and other kind of high tech places.
I'm privileged and enough to say yes. I mean, that's the reason I've been with this group of people for almost a decade in different roles and companies. Sticking together and being able to have that type of trust and cooperation, you know, even through the hard times, even through mistakes, through ups and downs of the economy, that level of trust is it's hard to get. It's hard to find.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah, the success definitely leaves breadcrumbs. If you look on the Descope website, the about page, you can just see kind of where one thing started, and then there was an acquisition and another thing started, but you know, the people stayed the same throughout with their 30 plus years of experience. So it's certainly all about putting the right people together and having that communication, as you said, from the very beginning. And yeah, it's nice to see.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm glad to be part of this group.
Fantastic. Well, it was a pleasure speaking with you, Omar. Hope all the best for the future. I know you guys closed out some nice seed financing at Descope as well. So just going from strength to strength. So wishing you guys all the best. And yeah, lovely speaking with you.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me, and I hope to talk again.